This is The Hollywood Outsider, an award-winning weekly movie and TV podcast, with a new episode available each week on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, your podcast app of choice, or TheHollywoodOutsider.com. I'm Aaron Peterson. I'm going to be your host for this special episode of The Hollywood Outsider. As our loyal listeners know, every once in a while, we like to bring you interviews with independent filmmakers to give you an insight into what goes into getting their films made, as well as insight into the respective film itself. This time we're talking about Never Here. Mira Eno stars as Miranda Fall. She's an installation artist who follows, photographs, and documents total strangers for her respective pieces. So after a show one night, her married lover Paul, who's played by Sam Shepard in his final role, he witnesses a crime outside Miranda's apartment. Miranda agrees to cover Paul's witnessing this crime, and Miranda takes his place. After she partakes in a lineup where she obviously cannot pick out the offender, I mean, she didn't actually see it, she follows one of the unique men in the lineup and begins a new art project. She begins to believe someone is also stalking her, and it could just be the man she believes to have committed the original crime, or is that just her voyeurism getting the best of her? Never Here for me is a film that really has shades of Hitchcock's films and The Bedroom Window, meshed with the more creative aspects of artistic expression. And anybody that's ever listened to the show knows I'm a huge Hitchcock fan. And so this concept was very novel. It's very unique to me. How do you take a thriller and make it a little more artistic without making it, without crossing that line? You know, there is that line which can border into, well, is it really not a thriller anymore? It's just a matter of art. No, it really holds its boundaries pretty firmly, and it's very much a thriller, while at the same time becoming kind of a thinking piece on voyeurism and many of our own beliefs that no one's privacy is really a secret in this day and age. So for this interview, I'm talking to the writer and director of Never Here, Camille Thomann. She has this unique canvas to showcase her film, and it piqued my interest in several different ways, because the basic construct is that of a thriller, yet there's a lot more at play here, and it bleeds into feelings of paranoia, and maybe even shades of our own voyeuristic guilt. She talks about the blending of genres within the film and why Mireille was the perfect choice for Miranda. And Mireille is absolutely riveting in this role, so please check it out just for that. I mean, her performance carries the entire film. I think she's in every scene, and she is magnificent. And also working with Sam Shepard on his final film. I really can't wait to see what Camille Thomann does next, because this was a great film, and what she talks about at the end of the interview sounds like another great film, and also right up my alley. So be sure to listen to the full interview, and then be sure to check out Never Here in theaters October 20th. I think you're going to enjoy it. Without further ado, here's my interview with Never Here writer-director Camille Thomann. Hi, Camille.
Hey, Aaron. How are you?
I am great. Where are you at today?
I'm in Santa Monica, California.
Nice. Beautiful.
Good old Santa Monica.
It's much better than...
Where are you?
Chicago. It's cold and wet, so...
Oh, wonderful. I'm just going to Chicago.
Are you?
On Monday. Looking forward to it.
For a premiere or?
Yes. Never Here will be at the Chicago, not a premiere, but a Midwest premiere.
Mm-hmm.
Never Here will be at the Chicago International Film Festival.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. On the 16th and 17th, we're playing October 16th and 17th.
Well, I'll be sure to spread the word. The first thing I always ask is when did you know you wanted to be a filmmaker? Was there a specific moment for you or?
I was very, very young. I think I was probably 5 or 6 when I started to play dress up with my friends and just direct plays. I wanted to direct plays. And then that right around 9, I took a video camera out and I was making plays and movies. And then my friends got bored of it. And then my sister's 5 years younger than me. So then it was her friends I was directing. So it happened pretty early for me. You know, for me, film and theater, I always wanted to do those two things.
When did you go from plays to movies where you decided, you know what, I'd rather be making a film than a play?
I think of it more as what's the idea? So in my 20s, I started my first actual film outside of the film I made when I was like, I made a couple films, if you can even call them that, when I was a child,
mm-hmm.
that are really funny. And then I made a few experimental films in college, short experimental films. And then I started getting into performance art and live theater.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I was about 25, after I had been doing performance art for a few years, I just woke up with a film idea. And I was like, oh, this is what I want to do. So it's more just like, what was the idea? And as it's happened in the last 10 years, all my ideas have been film. And right now I'm very streamlined and focused on film. But I hope to continue to do theater as well.
Well, you went from The Longest Game, which followed a trio of elderly men playing paddle tennis and discussing life, right? And now you're doing a kind of a Hitchcockian theme with very artistic influences. And I'm hoping I can be one of the first ones to ask you, because I'm sure you'll get this question a lot, but what is the underlying theme to your work so far?
Oh, to me, I see them as very similar pieces. My adorable, funny, poignant documentary about old men is also a film about cycles of life and metamorphosis and the inevitability of change. And my Hitchcockian thriller, classic Hitchcockian suspense mystery, is in many ways like a whodunit, but it's also very much of a who am I. Mm-hmm. And very much explores the inevitability of change of a person and the unknowableness of a person. So it's very, and the idea that nothing is fixed. So that's really what links the two films. They have very different tones. Never Here is more mm-hmm. like scary and more of a thriller, disturbing and disquieting. And The Longest Game is more redemptive, and they look at and uplifting, and they look at the two sides, they look at all the emotions that can be brought up by change.
Well, you speak of tones. One of the things that really stood out to me is how you combine the aspects of a typical thriller with almost performance art. And I want to know, like, what about those two styles felt like a natural meshing of elements for you?
I don't know. It just, again, it felt like how cool to give an audience like a traditional mystery on some levels, a traditional suspense Hitchcock thing on some levels, mm-hmm. and also be probing the audience, the viewer, about their own identity. I thought that was a really cool thing. So yeah, that's the role of the artist, is to entertain and also to probe, I feel.
I really, really enjoyed the movie. I'm a huge Hitchcock fan. That's my favorite director.
Cool. But thank you.
You're welcome. I really liked how it's really difficult to pigeonhole what kind of film it is, because it does kind of go in several different directions. And I feel like we're in an era where a lot of filmmakers feel like they need to spell out every single detail for audiences. And Never Here really chose specifically to leave a lot to people's imagination. So were you always confident mm-hmm. that should be the natural state of the film? Did that ever concern you about leaving it so much to what people decide?
I was always confident that was the way the film should be. Yes, absolutely. I wasn't always confident that we were going to be able to get it made because it took a long time for that reason. You know, people were like, no, it can't be like this. You can't make a movie like this.
Was that a big struggle? Because people wanted answers. They wanted it very clear and defined.
They wanted answers. There was lots of things they wanted. yes, they did want it. Somebody said to me, I don't even know if this is going to make sense to your listeners mm-hmm. because they haven't seen the movie, but somebody said to me, look, we'll finance the movie if at the end of the movie you have S looking at a mirror and he takes off a mask and really he's Paul.
What?
I was like, oh gosh. Yeah. So I did want to make some concession. I mean, not even concessions. I do feel it's really important to entertain an audience. It's not just about taking them down a rabbit hole and asking them questions of identity. Mm-hmm. So it was really about doing both those things. Keeping them kind of titillated and entertained, and then also looking at bigger life questions. And yeah, it was really hard to get that made. Thank God I had the best team of producers in the entire world who stuck with the project for years. I don't know why they did. You'll have to ask them. I'm sure they're asking themselves the same question, but really amazing, amazing dedicated producers, like incredible. And of course, Mireille also a champion of the movie and a friend of the movie for years and years. So really amazing team.
We're going to get to her because she was great. I have one other big question amazing. Before we get to her. Your film has several visual cues as to what is happening. And I really like how you kind of get people going that this might be a thing, you know, when this is the beginning, right at the beginning. So, and I thought some were very subtle, others were very direct. So I want to know, when you were structuring the film, both with the screenplay and the physical production, how difficult was it for you to set those up and layer them so they never feel like they're either overdone or too revealing?
I just went with my instinct on that one. The idea behind it was to, the film is really looking at the construction of someone's identity and a constructed universe. What's artifice and what's real? So there were signs, literal physical signs, like you say, to almost flag for the spectator, hey, this is a film that knows it's a film. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, balancing that, there has to be a very, in some scenes, very naturalistic, deep performances by brilliant actors. So it's not just a kind of an empty intellectual exercise. I really wanted there to be able to feel the humanity of Miranda, even though you might question her decisions. So it was a balancing act, and I just went with what I felt would be right.
You speak of Marae, and she has been great in everything she's done. People are familiar with her.
Everything.
But I think she smiled more in this movie than she has in her entire career, because she's had such heavy, dark, deep work. She's smiling through half the movie, half.
That's so funny.
What about her really sung to you that she was the perfect choice for Miranda?
Well, first of all, I didn't want people to, you know, Miranda has a quality about her in person. Mm-hmm. And I think it comes through all of her performances. She's a very lovely person. I wanted Miranda, because Miranda is doing these things you could construe as horrible. Mm-hmm. I didn't want the audience to hate Miranda. I mean, some people are going to hate Miranda, and that's understandable. But I wanted also just the person to playing Miranda to be somebody who was charming and likable and sweet. That, on top of the fact that I really think Mireille is possibly the most skilled actress of right now, I mean, of her generation, you know, Miranda is on screen the entire film, mm-hmm. and she's called to do so many different kinds of things. And there's so many performance styles. She has to be very physical in some scenes, very stylized in some scenes, and extremely raw in other scenes. And Mireille can do all of that. And there's not very many actresses, I think, that have that kind of range. I would say those are the main things, just her and the fact that she has a genuine charm and likability about her. Both of those things made her, in my mind. I mean, I wrote the part for her.
Oh, did you? Like directly for her?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I didn't think I'd necessarily be able to get her to be in it, but I did. Yeah. I mean, Mireille is nothing like Miranda. Mireille is like, they couldn't be more different people, but I called Miranda after Mireille in a kind of like wishful thinking.
Well planned
scenario. Yeah. And Mireille actually gave me notes. We were friends. So she actually gave me notes on a very early version of the script. Actually, there's a funny story. She's like the second or third person to read the script. This is like years ago. Mm-hmm. And we were having lunch, and she was like, it was really great. And I just had a few thoughts. And Mireille is extremely professional and diplomatic and sweet, always. And then I looked down at her notes, and she had written, "This must change!" !! "This also!" !! And I took her notes, and they were really good. They were really excellent notes.
Well, that's nice. So it was partly a collaboration in some respects.
Oh, in many respects, it was a collaboration. Not only between her and I, but, I mean, filmmaking is inevitably a huge collaboration. So I was always getting notes from people I respected. Mireille, the producers, friends. So it was a collaboration in many, many, many ways.
Were you ever concerned about some of her darker leanings, the character Miranda, in terms of, I mean, she becomes somewhat of a stalker herself. Did that ever concern you?
Yeah. Well, it didn't concern me at all, But it did, again, I was like, are we going to be able to get this made? Because there's a thing that women need to be likable. And that's a note I got over and over and over again. Oh, this character isn't likable. We can't make this movie. Can you do flashbacks where you get to like her more? And it was concerning to me in that respect that were we ever going to be able to make the movie.
Is that different than the notes would be if it was a guy?
I think definitely. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's ridiculous.
It's changing. It's changing. I think we're seeing a lot more, nuanced characters. But that was her likability factor was a big, I think, one of the reasons it was so hard to get the movie financed and made.
Well, I'm glad you held strong because it really is. It's a fascinating character study.
Thank you. Thank you so much for saying so. Yeah, I don't dislike that character. I think she's really interesting. I think she makes very questionable decisions, bad decisions, I would even say. But she's a very interesting character to me. And then her past and her psychology is revealed, and the reasons for what she does is revealed. I don't actually find her dislikable. I find her fascinating.
I found her human. Yeah. She's very human. We're all flawed.
Nice to hear. Thank you. We're all flawed. Yeah, we're all flawed. And she is kind of crazy. She makes kind of crazy decisions.
Yeah, she's a little wacky.
Interesting ones.
She's a little wacky, but I'd hang out with her.
Yes.
One thing, I would regret it if I didn't ask, but this was Sam Shepard's last film. So can you talk a little about what that experience working with Sam was like?
I absolutely loved working with him. He was a very inspiring person to be around. And so it was great working with him, and it was just great being around him. So I can't say enough nice things about Sam. I'm very humbled that this is his last project, and sad that he's gone.
I think he'd be proud. I really do.
Oh, thank you. I hope so. I really hope so.
I mean, he's got a strong filmography, and this will hold with it. That's a good compliment.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. This is your first feature film, because you did the documentary, and this is your first narrative feature film. Mm-hmm. What would you say is the most complicated aspect of putting the whole thing together, now that you finally got it made?
Oh my gosh, so many complicated aspects. I think maybe just getting it made was the most complicated aspect. It really took a lot, and not just from me, but from our whole team of producers. So that I think was just the number of years we put into actually getting the film made was really, none of us knew what we were signing up for quite. And then also on the other end, I think once it was made, initially people's reactions, again, we kind of had to go through the same thing. People saying like, oh no, this isn't right. You have to make it feel more like other movies. So I would actually, for me personally, once the edit was complete, before we had a breakthrough and people started saying, oh, actually, this is pretty cool, there were a lot of industry people who could not understand what the film was. And that, I think, was also complicated for all of us because we had put so many years into it. Mm-hmm. That's the, that's the complication, to use your word, of making a film that has a different frequency from the ones that you see more, but basically a genre blend rather than stay in their specific genre.
The movie's outside the box. It is outside the box. It's not
a
standard
exactly.
thriller. And, well, I know I got to let you go, but what's next for you? Do you have another project lined up, or are you still kind of going forward?
Yes. Well, I'm writing a horror film at the moment.
What kind? Can you talk about it at all? Or?
Yes. It's not so much a genre blend. It's pretty just straight horror, elevated horror, kind of in the vein of It Follows or The Babadook or The Shining. I would not say it's a genre blend. It explores the demonic and how the demonic is really basically self-hatred. And it takes place in a mining town in northern Canada.
Ooh.
And it's really scary. It's really, really scary. And I'm writing it now, so I don't know when it'll come out. But I've given myself 24 months. This time I want it to be made in 24 months. That's what I'm really hoping. Hopefully, you and I don't do a podcast in 10 years, and I laugh about that it took another 10 years. But I'm hoping that this one gets made. faster than the last one.
That sounds riveting. Yeah, let us know when it's coming out. I love a good horror movie.
Awesome. I look forward to sharing it with you. I definitely will.
Well, I got to let you go, but thanks so much for stopping by. I really do appreciate it, and best of luck on the movie. It's great.
It was my pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for taking the time to watch the film, and thank you for your comments. And great talking to you. I look forward to talking to you again.
Will do. I'm looking forward to it. 2 years. Mark it.
24 months.
Got
cool.
It.
Awesome.
All right.
All right. Have a lovely day.
You too. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
There you go, guys. That was my interview with Camille Thomann, the writer and director of Never Here, once again in theaters October 20th. I hope you guys check it out. I really do. It's an interesting, unique film. It's its own thing. There's so many thrillers out there that are just like every other thriller. This one is not. And Mira Enos is phenomenal. Just phenomenal in the film. She really captures so many different things. I loved her in The Killing, and she's done tons of great work. I wasn't kidding. She really smiles more in this movie than I think I've ever seen, other than interviews where she's always joyful and smiling from ear to ear. Usually in her movies, it's very dark, and harrowing is the word I would use. In this film, she's very deep, very haunting. It's a very enigmatic performance, and I really hope you guys will check it out. Once again, thank you for listening to the Hollywood Outsider Podcast. We try to bring you interviews with filmmakers in the world of cinema whenever we can, so I really hope you enjoyed this one. Remember to subscribe and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your podcast app of choice. Our normal show has a new episode every single week and is available at thehollywoodoutsider.com. This is Aaron Peterson reminding you that the next time you head into the theater, October 20th, to see Never Here, buy popcorn.